I just don't feel like we can leave this session without some place where this project is going to continue to be evaluated in the event that AGEA goes sideways.
A plan to put the Alaska Railroad in charge of an in-state gas line. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 19th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congress heads for a weekend vote on health care legislation.
This is a first step in doing the right thing and making sure that people can access affordable health care, that we have controls on these insurance companies.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
As U.S. House Democrats whip up support for Sunday's vote on health care legislation, Alaska's delegation has not shifted its position. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Representative Don Young and all other House Republicans are unified in voting against the bill. Young took to the House floor today for the second time this week to complain about the legislation, which he says will grow government. Young read from a section he called convoluted.
And two, the commissioner shall pay the QHBP offering entity that offers such plan for the Health Insurance Exchange Trust Fund an aggregate amount of affordable credit for all individuals enrolled in the plan. Over 1,000 pages of gobbledygook. I have an old saying, you should have been kissed. Keep it simple. Stupid.
The Republican members of Alaska's delegation are also blasting the process. House Democrats are using an approach called deem and pass, by which members wouldn't vote on the actual bill. Instead, they can deem the Senate's version approved if House members adopt a set of changes. It's a tactic that's been used by both sides of the aisle, but rarely for such a high-profile final vote. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke out against it this week, calling it March Madness.
We've got every right to be questioning that. We've got every right to be making sure that people understand clearly what is happening here in Congress in an effort to move health care reform is wrong, it's unacceptable, and we ought not to allow it to move forward.
Murkowski warns it could cut Medicare and increase taxes. But Alaska's Democratic Senator Mark Begich says even though the bill is, in his eyes, not perfect, it goes a long way to improving health care for Americans.
This is a first step in doing the right thing and making sure that people can access affordable health care, that we have controls on these insurance companies that over the years have just been kind of running as they see fit and telling patients and individuals what they will get for health care. And I think this now puts some control back into the individual's hands. People will be able to keep their doctors, the Indian health care legislation that's in there. 21 years, it's been pending to be reauthorized. It will be reauthorized. And I think it will have a lot of positive things.
Begich says the House follows its own procedures, but in the Senate, he says this has been one of the longest debates in the history of Congress.
From the Senate side, we've done a pretty good job. I mean, the amount of days we had in debate on the floor, the amount of hearings that or public hearings that I held or telehearings that I've done, and we have received literally thousands of emails and contacts to our office for and against this legislation. And I think we've had a pretty good airing of this issue.
The latest version of the bill costs $940 billion, but would reduce the budget by $138 billion over a decade and by $1.2 trillion in the next 10 years. It would cover more than 30 million uninsured Americans and would require nearly everyone to be insured or face penalties. Attached to the health care bill is a plan to overhaul college student loans through the budget reconciliation process. It would cut out private banks, which are paid by the feds to make risk-free loans. Democrats say that will save money. But Republican Lisa Murkowski calls it a government takeover and says it could clog up the loan program.
If I, as a parent, now realize that my source of information is going to be one of four national call lines in this country, I'm here to tell you, the public wants us to do things that make sense and help them. But again, this is just part of the March Madness that we're seeing here in Congress.
Begich says he's not a fan of including the student loan bill in reconciliation, but says ultimately he supports the idea.
I would have been happy to see that separate because I think who wouldn't support that? But I think timing is the issue. In order to process this, the Pell Grants, people who want to go to higher education as we move into the fall, they'll be working on that now. So it's probably smart to get that out of the way so families can plan on what kind of support they'll have for higher education through the Pell Grant. And it's a deficit reducer. That's a good thing.
If House Democrats manage to wrangle their needed 216 votes on Sunday, the health care bill will go to the president for his signature, and the Senate will have to grapple next week with a smaller, separate bill of revisions. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Governor Sean Parnell is proposing a cut to the state tax on cruise ship passengers to help an industry that says the cost of doing business in Alaska is too high. During a speech in Anchorage today, Parnell said he wants to cut the $46 head tax for cruise ship passengers to $34.50. He says he'll also seek offsets for passenger taxes paid in some ports. Parnell says he'll ask lawmakers to tack the tax reduction proposal to a tourism marketing bill. That measure has so far garnered little traction in the legislature, which is currently set to end its session next month. The proposal follows Parnell's trip to a cruise industry convention in Florida. Governor Parnell said yesterday he supports a bill that would make the Alaska Railroad responsible for developing an in-state gas line from the North Slope. In a letter to Senate Resources co-chair, Anchorage Republican Liesl McGuire, Parnell said he supports the gas line project that TransCanada and Exxon are working on under a state license, but he also says the state should not limit its options by picking only one path that may or may not lead to a project. McGuire told the Resources Committee that the railroad has the people and the ability to take over the job, and something needs to be done quickly to provide gas to the rail belt.
I just don't feel like we can leave this session without some place where this project is going to continue to be evaluated in the event that AGEA goes sideways.
She says AGEA, the pipeline from the North Slope to Canada, could face economic or political problems, or it could simply result in a lack of interest from North American markets, which will not be discovered until this coming fall, when the results of the first industry response to the plan will be made public. The bill got some other high-profile support from many of Alaska's former and future leaders. Former U.S. Senator Ted Stevens told the committee that he doesn't want to abandon AGEA. He says the North American market will do that. He said the future is in export markets.
Gas in the Pacific Rim is sold at oil prices. It's $2 to $4 more per MCF over there than it is in the United States. LNG is. Now, when you look at that, that's a profit margin that we ought to enjoy and build up some cash reserves.
Stevens advised the senators not to wait to act. He said the state should find a way to invest in an in-state gas line and get it underway. He says the project needs momentum. Other support came from former Governor Bill Sheffield, who said the public doesn't want to wait. People want something to happen.
What I'm saying is that you either build it yourself, the state of Alaska build it themselves, take that $4 billion it might cost, or $5 billion it might cost, just put up the money yourself and not get the money back, not charge for the transportation, not charge for the cost of the pipeline.
Outgoing Railroad President and CEO Pat Gamble says he has the people and the structure to turn the project around quickly, and with an anchor user such as ConocoPhillips Export Facility, the project would be reasonable. Former Governor Frank Murkowski is on board also, telling the committee that overseas markets know Alaska well. He says all the state needs is the infrastructure to deliver more gas and at a price that will make it affordable. The bill will be back before the Senate Resources Committee on Monday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists defend a theory on why dinosaurs went extinct.
One asteroid that was probably 10 to 15 kilometers across that created a crater that's about 200 kilometers in diameter.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com.
ConocoPhillips has named a new president of its Alaska operations, Trond Erik Johansen, who currently heads the company's Southeast Asia Exploration and Production Group in Singapore, will take over Alaska operations on April 1st. Johansen's predecessor, Jim Bowles, died in an avalanche in Alaska last month. Houston-based ConocoPhillips is Alaska's largest oil and gas producer. It's also a major leaseholder. The company's interests also include running a liquefied natural gas facility on the Kenai Peninsula. Johansen has been with ConocoPhillips for more than two decades in various positions around the world. A bill in the state legislature would open the corridor of state land along the Dalton Highway to snow machining. House Bill 267 would allow snow machines within a five-mile strip along the right-of-way from October 1st through April 30th. Fairbanks Game Board member Al Barrett is behind the bill. He says the Dalton was only closed to snow machining out of concern for caribou back when the road first opened to the public.
The Central Arctic caribou herd was estimated at 5,000 caribou, and there was some concern about the people living in that area being able to use those caribou. 30 years to the present, the caribou herd's at 67,000 to 70,000 caribou.
Reflecting the growth of the herd, the Game Board recently increased the bag limit for caribou in an area that includes the Dalton Highway corridor north of Attigan Pass to five animals. Hearings on the bill to open up snow machine access along the Dalton have drawn mixed opinions. Fairbanks resident Nicole Fliss owns a home off the highway and heads up an opposition group that represents a broad range of people.
We have stakeholders, not just including environmentalists. You know, we have local people, truckers, tour operators, firearm hunters, bow hunters, native leaders, North Slope Borough folks, biologists, pipeline service company, who are all opposed to opening the corridor to snow machine use or any motorized use beyond just what is locally and currently allowed.
Full-time Dalton Highway residents have always been permitted to use snow machines along the road, but Fliss says the state promised not to expand that to the general public. Fliss says there are also safety concerns because of the lack of parking and unloading areas along the Dalton. Fairbanks Representative Mike Kelly is sponsoring the bill. Another committee hearing is set for Monday. Juneau lawmakers say they want a better explanation for relocating a high-profile fish and game position to Anchorage. Senator Dennis Egan and Representative Beth Kurtula have sent a letter to Commissioner Denby Lloyd asking why the Wildlife Conservation Director has been relocated. Lloyd last week appointed Corey Rossi, who says he probably wouldn't have taken the job if he had to move to the capital city. Rossi has also drawn criticism for his close ties to big game hunting groups, pushing for more predator control programs. From KTOO in Juneau, Casey Kelly reports.
Juneau Senator Dennis Egan says he's sure Corey Rossi could work from just about anywhere, but that's not the point.
Mr. Rossi could probably move to Seattle if they would allow him to do that. I just think that that position ought to remain here in the capital city, at headquarters of the Department of Fish and Game.
In their letter to Commissioner Denby Lloyd this week, Egan and Representative Beth Kurtula demand to know the rationale behind the move. Locating this important position in Juneau, they write, appears to have served your department well for nearly 20 years. They say they've heard no convincing explanation on how the move will enhance wildlife management. Lloyd says he saw no reason to make Rossi and his family relocate to Juneau. He says Rossi's former position as assistant commissioner will be reassigned to the capital city, resulting in no net loss of jobs. Rossi joined Fish and Game in December 2008 in the newly created position of assistant commissioner at a time Alaska was facing a significant budget shortfall. The move raised eyebrows in some hunting and conservation circles, especially because of Rossi's friendship with then-Governor Sarah Palin, who less than a month later called for a state hiring freeze. Rossi says it's unfair to criticize his relationship with Palin.
I didn't know that there was a penalty associated with him, you know, being a friend of a governor.
Rossi's predecessor as division director, Doug Larson, has been demoted to his old position as regional supervisor for Southeast Alaska. Lloyd says Larson didn't object to the move, and he never felt pressure from either the Palin or Parnell administrations to hire or promote Rossi. Lloyd says he was just looking for a change in leadership.
I've come to know Corey pretty well over the past year that he's been in an assistant commissioner role, and what he exhibits is a can-do, a fairly direct administrative style, and I was looking for more of that in our wildlife conservation programs.
But to some, Rossi's appointment signals the department's shift to a more aggressive approach to predator control. Prior to joining the state payroll, Rossi was a board member for the Alaska chapter of Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. SFW supports abundance-based management measures and advocates killing bears, wolves, and other predators as a means to boost the number of big game species available to hunters. Dave Lyon lives in Homer and is co-chair of Alaska Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, a group that opposes predator control methods.
Corey Rossi being put in this position that he is in now gives him sort of an undue and inappropriate avenue all of a sudden to see that SFW's agenda is carried out.
Lyon says predator control programs may increase the number of big game species available to hunters, but they often ignore other factors in wildlife management.
You can't just manage for abundance. You have to manage an ecosystem.
Rossi says he doesn't always believe in using predator control. For instance, when he first joined the department, he ended a program near Tok to control the grizzly bear population.
There's no sense in just dawdling along and randomly taking a predator here and there so we can feel good about taking a predator. That's not the goal. You know, if the program isn't effective in actually temporarily, you know, suppressing those predator numbers so that we can get the ungulates to respond accordingly, then we're really kind of, you know, wasting our time and not fulfilling the objectives.
Rossi says his goal is to fulfill the department's objective to manage for multiple uses. He says that means appeasing both hunters and non-hunters who enjoy Alaska's wildlife. Before joining Fish and Game, he spent more than 20 years with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services Program, dealing mostly with permitting issues surrounding human-animal conflicts. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Their mission is to advocate for children and youth by assisting school boards to provide quality public education, supporting student achievement and local governance. Information at aasb.org. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
Construction has begun on the first Veterans Administration Health Clinic in Southeast Alaska. Contractors started the work Monday on the first floor of the Juneau Federal Building. Marcia Hoffman-DeVoe of the Alaska Regional VA office says the Juneau Clinic will offer primary care, everything from flu shots to diagnostic services to mental health.
If the person needs to have a specialist, for example, once they see the primary care doctor and the primary care doctor says, I'd like to have you evaluated by a general surgeon or by a urologist or by an orthopedic doctor, then we would set that veteran up to either see one of our specialists at our VA clinic here in Anchorage, which has those specialties, or possibly a referral to the VA at the VA Puget Sound in Seattle.
Hoffman-DeVoe says the Juneau Clinic will be open about the middle of July. For the last few years, many opponents of the proposed Pebble Mine have called for a comprehensive examination of the potential impacts of a large-scale mineral extraction project in the Bristol Bay watershed. Just such an examination is in legislation introduced in the Alaska Legislature. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
House Concurrent Resolution 15 asked the Legislative Council to contract with the National Research Council to conduct an independent assessment of the consequences of a large-scale mineral extraction project in the Bristol Bay watershed. The resolution was introduced by Representative Alan Osterman from Kodiak, and it has to run the gauntlet of the House Fisheries, Resources, and Finance Committees before ever reaching the floor of the House. It would then need to make it through the Senate before the end of the session next month. That would seem daunting, but the resolution has a strong supporter in District 37 State Representative Bryce Edgman from Dillingham, who chairs the House Fisheries Committee.
I fully support having the Academy do this holistic review of the mine, and not just from the sort of the environmental perspective as the NEPA process would under the current permitting system, but to stand back and look at all the socioeconomic factors, to look at impact on the demographics, to look at the impact on the whole watershed from every imaginable perspective.
One of the underlying concerns about developing the Pebble Mine is that pollution from a mine could end up in the Nooshiegak and Quijack Rivers, which are major drivers for the yearly salmon runs that have made Bristol Bay famous. One of the organizations opposing the resolution is the Alaska Miners Association. The group's executive director is Steve Burrell. He says the resolution, if passed, will have a chilling effect on anyone contemplating investing in mineral exploration in Alaska. In a letter that was sent to the chair of the House Fisheries Committee, Burrell wrote that if HCR 15 passes even just the Fisheries Committee, the negative impacts will be felt in this summer's exploration levels.
People know that Pebble is under tremendous attack, and they're going to say, oh, so they're going to derail Pebble with this. And if something which that appears to be as good a project as Pebble can get derailed by something like this, why do I have a chance?
House Concurrent Resolution 15 has been referred to the House Fisheries Committee, but a hearing for the resolution has yet to be scheduled. One of the organizations supporting the resolution is Trout Unlimited. Lindsay Bloom is a Bristol Bay commercial fisherwoman, and she's a spokesperson for Trout Unlimited.
The Pebble debate has become so contentious and so heated amongst many of us stakeholders and lawmakers and agency officials in the state of Alaska. I think bringing in an outside third party like what's suggested in the resolution, the National Academy of Sciences, would be incredibly healthy.
House Concurrent Resolution 15 has a sister resolution that was introduced last week in the state Senate. Senate Concurrent Resolution 6 has been referred to the Senate Resources Committee, but a hearing has yet to be set. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks is adding new fuel to a long-established theory on what caused the dinosaurs to go extinct. Michael Whalen is a contributing author to a study published in the journal Science earlier this month that argues a massive asteroid slamming into the Yucatan Peninsula eventually led to the mass extinction event. The article is in part a response to another theory that the extinction was caused by long-term volcanic activity in India. But Whalen says the evidence points to the asteroid as the culprit.
You know, that's not to say that there may not have been other mitigating factors, but we think that this single event was so catastrophic that it probably was the main thing that drove dinosaurs, as well as a number of other taxa, to extinction.
One asteroid
that was probably 10 to 15 kilometers across that created a crater that's about 200 kilometers in diameter.
How well is the theory accepted among scientists?
Well, as with lots of scientific theories, there are competing camps that have different ideas about what may have played the role in the extinction event. But there's a fairly large proportion of scientists that believe this was at least the major contributing factor, if not, the real thing that did the deed. But science really isn't necessarily done by consensus. It really has to do with the preponderance of evidence that is out there. So there are competing hypotheses for what may have caused this extinction event. The other main one being that there's a large volcanic series of events in India called the Deccan Traps that released a lot of lava as well as other gases and things over several million years leading up to the extinction event.
And talk a little bit about where the theory does fall apart.
Well, the main place where we think that this hypothesis offers sort of more explanatory power is just the sheer magnitude
of the event itself and what would have happened as all of the material that was involved in this impact was thrown up into the atmosphere. So all of this is going up into the atmosphere in literally an instant when you're, you know, when you think about it, especially in geologic terms. Whereas if you're comparing it to what's going on with this volcanism in India, it probably did have some somewhat catastrophic events, and there have been some recent papers that have come out that have tried to quantify the amount of gases that would come out in individual volcanic events associated with these Deccan traps. And some of those probably were somewhat catastrophic, but just as far as the sheer magnitude in comparison with what we would expect to have happened at the Chicxulub impact, it's dwarfed by what would happen at the impact event.
Do you think there's evidence, any evidence to support what they're talking about?
Well, there's certainly evidence that these kinds of volcanic events could have some environmental impacts. Nobody in our group would argue against that. But what we see in the extinction record is a relatively abrupt extinction event associated with this boundary. Whereas, you know, if these volcanic events had had significant impacts on the different organisms that are living out there, we would expect to see a gradual decline in things over time up to the boundary, and that's really not what the record tells us.
Why was it important to publish an article defending the asteroid theory?
We, as a group, we felt that there had been some misinterpretations that had made it into the literature, things that were, you know, and that's, you know, based on just scientific differences of opinion on how to interpret the data, but you know, we felt strongly enough that this hypothesis has been maligned in the literature over the past several years, and we've generated new data over the same time period, and we just thought it was a good idea to forcefully try to make our point.
Michael Whalen is an associate professor of geology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.